Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we have the ruling in a case filed by Alpine taxpayers against the Grossmont Union High School District seeking an injunction to set aside funds for an Alpine high school. Hear what the judge decided on today's show. Soytech may be preparing to exit the solar business. We'll tell you why. And later in the show, we'll also be interviewing Donna Tisdale, chair of the Boulevard Planning Group and founder of a citizens group that has announced plans to sue the county if supervisors approve Soytech's controversial industrial solar projects in East County. There's a surprising twist in the double homicide case on the Barona Reservation in Lakeside, and we'll have details. From Public News Service, learn about national protests marking the anniversary of the Citizens United ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court. On Crime Beat, hear why the sheriff needs your help to nab some vandals doing major damage in Lakeside. Then on our local government report, we'll tell you about some hot items on the agendas of local councils and boards here in East County this week. We'll also have some promising economic news on our region's unemployment rate. And in our weather report, learn why you may want to keep an umbrella handy this week. We'll have details about a police sting in La Mesa targeting people providing alcohol to minors. On Green Scene, you'll hear from President Barack Obama on why he wants to preserve 12 million acres in Alaska as wilderness and why his plan may face tough sledding in Congress. On Bookshelf, Raina Menashe interviews Kirk Lee Adler on his book about a surfing star. We'll also have details on a new study out about how the Colorado River impacts California's economy. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
The Grossmont Union High School District must set aside $14 million in bond money immediately and another $28 million by January 2016 to fund building a high school in Alpine. Superior Court Judge Joel Pressman issued the ruling Thursday, granting an injunction sought by Alpine taxpayers for bond accountability. Priscilla Schreiber, the only member of the Grossmont Board who has consistently supported building the high school in Alpine, told East County Magazine, "I'm thrilled." But a statement from the district claims that other schools in the district will not get needed improvements due to the court's decision. The district indicates it will be back in court January 28th, filing for a stay in hopes of halting the injunction. District voters twice approved bond measures, Proposition U and H, that called specifically for an Alpine High School to be built. The Grossmont District reneged on its promise to build the school, claiming enrollment triggers were not met, a point disputed by supporters of the school. A grand jury sided with Alpine parents, but the district defied the grand jury's recommendations. As a result, Alpine parents have sought to leave the Grossmont District and unify the Alpine School District to become K through 12 and allow it to build a high school. A statement from the Grossmont District claims the judge's decision will have a grave impact that will mean several years of delays in modernizing classrooms and investing in technology and safety upgrades at existing schools, as well as building a performing arts space at Santana High School and an event center at Grossmont High School. But Schreiber counters that the district squandered bond money by building performing arts centers that were double the cost of multi-purpose facilities called for in the bond, money that could have been used on priorities such as safety and modernization of classrooms. She also faulted GUHSD attorney Warrington Parker III for telling the judge that Alpine plaintiffs were money grabbers who were just going to take the money and run to use it for unification. "It was disgusting," she says, adding that the purpose of unification is to build the long-promised high school that the Grossmont District has refused to build. Safety is a concern for Alpine parents, too, since several Alpine teens have died on the highways commuting long distances to school or after-school campus activities. As Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ.
Soitec Solar may exit the solar business, Greentech Media reports. A quarterly report indicates the company plans to refocus its efforts on its electronics business. Greentech's article indicates that the language may be vague, but the publication predicts the message is clear. Soitec is exiting this business as quickly as possible. The news comes as San Diego supervisors are poised to vote February 4th on whether to approve massive industrial solar projects proposed by Soitec and Boulevard here in East County. But Soitec's financial situation is precarious. The company's stock plummeted to a quarter of its prior value recently, and this week, Soitec announced layoff of 100 employees at its Rancho Bernardo Solar photovoltaic factory. Donna Tisdale, chair of the Boulevard Planning Group, says she believes Soitec Solar is just one more example of government-selected winners that turn out to be big losers, all at the expense of taxpayers, ratepayers, and impacted communities. And yet the county planners and planning commissioners have recommended approval to convert over 1,000 acres of Boulevard neighborhoods into Soitec projects, with 160 cargo containers of highly flammable batteries and about 10 miles of new overhead high-voltage lines using millions of gallons of drought-stressed groundwater for the solar projects. She believes supervisors may be poised to approve the project despite its devastating impacts on her community, wildlife, and the ecosystem of the region. Tisdale is asking that people throughout the county call or email their supervisors to voice opposition to these projects called Rugged Solar and Tierra del Sol before February 4th. Backers say the projects would help reduce greenhouse gas emissions and meet state renewable energy goals, but opponents say the goals could be met through incentivizing rooftop solar instead of negatively impacting residents in a rural community, as well as views along a designated scenic highway. We'll be interviewing Donna Tisdale later on today's show.
This is Hayden Parsley with a Crime Beat report. Elena Rose Welch, who was arrested following the deaths of her child and boyfriend on the Barona Reservation last week, was released from jail Thursday. Tribal police responded to a call about an attempted suicide, and the sheriff's department responded to a call reporting her baby was dead. The police spoke to a man, now known to be her boyfriend, Julio Ricardo Mangiotti, who then entered the home and a shot was heard. Welch exited the home and dropped a shotgun on the road. When the police entered the home, they found the corpse of her baby hidden in a freezer, and Mangiotti dead, with gunshot wounds to his chest and wrist. This incident had prompted much of the area to be shut down and even SWAT intervention. Welch has been released with no charges, a highly unusual move in a double homicide case. This calls into question many details of the case. Welch's father reportedly said that he had heard Welch yell, "He killed my baby," from within the house. Mangiotti was an ex-army member, and Welch's mother reported Welch being seen with bruises and a busted lip, possibly indicating Mangiotti had been abusing Welch. These statements raise speculation whether it was, in fact, Mangiotti who may have killed the baby, and whether he may have been killed in self-defense or even suicide. The case is still under investigation, however. Though Welch has been released, there is no statute of limitations on homicide, and she may be arrested again if new evidence surfaces.
Members of the group 99 Rise Sacramento marched near the state capitol on Wednesday to try to get big money out of politics. It was one of many protests held around the nation to mark the fifth anniversary of the controversial Citizens United decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. The ruling removed limits on the amount of money an independent organization can spend on political campaigns. Stephen Spalding with the nonpartisan group Common Cause says the result is that millionaires and billionaires have greater influence over elections at every level of government.
We need everyone to speak out loudly and clearly to say that enough is enough. They're sick and tired of the undue influence of corporate money, money from deep-pocketed special interests and lobbyists in our politics.
Spalding says a new report from Common Cause shows that donations from secret sources to activist organizations have influenced issues that range from minimum wage and gun control to climate change and having an open internet. He adds that political campaign spending from undisclosed sources topped $170 million in 2014 and was more than $300 million during the 2012 presidential election.
And we're well over $500 million in money that is untraceable, that has been dumped into our elections that otherwise likely would not have been spent but for Citizens United.
Spalding says the impact of Citizens United could be reduced or even eliminated by laws increasing disclosure of the donations made for independent campaign spending. Last summer, the California Supreme Court blocked an advisory ballot measure that would have asked California voters if Congress should overturn Citizens United. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. Today, my very special guest is Donna Tisdale, who is the chair of the Boulevard Planning Group, as well as the founder of Backcountry Against Dumps, or BAD. Donna, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Miriam.
We're talking today about a very important vote coming up, a hearing coming up on February 4th before the County Board of Supervisors about industrial-scale solar projects proposed by Soitec Solar that, if approved, would radically change the face of the backcountry forever. Donna, can you start by telling us a little bit about the areas where these would go in? And your planning group voted unanimously to oppose these, but last week the county planners ignored that recommendation and recommended approving two of the four projects. And now the supervisors will have the option to approve all of them, none of them, some of them. We don't really know what they're going to do. Tell us what the land is like where these projects are proposed, and give us an idea of the scale of them as well.
Well, two of the Soitec projects were approved by the planning commissioners. Almost 800 acres for the Rugged Solar is located in McCain Valley. It would straddle the Tule Creek floodplain, which drains into Tule Lake. This is at the entrance of the McCain Valley Resource Conservation Area and Recreation Area and many wilderness areas. So to go and recreate in the backcountry, you would have to drive through these 30-foot tall, 800 acres of glaring solar panels.
Yeah, each one of these is 30 feet tall.
And 50 feet wide.
50 feet wide, yeah. And this along a designated scenic highway. So I'm not sure if that's the kind of scenery folks had in mind when that designation was given out.
And the second project is the 420-acre Tierra del Sol project, which is located down on the U.S.-Mexico border with homes as close as 100 feet wow. and immediately across from Jardines del Rincón, which is an ejido on the Mexican side of the border.
100 feet. Can you imagine walking out your front door, folks, and looking at a veritable sea of solar panels of this scale staring at you? And now, Donna, when people bought out there in this community, what were the rules as far as what you could or couldn't put on your property and how big those?
Due to the fact that we are groundwater dependent and we have limited resources and services, during the general plan update in 2011, the Board of Supervisors approved one dwelling unit per 80 acres on these two project sites. So a total of 15 homes would be allowed where they're proposing to put, you know, almost 2 square miles of solar panels. It's just, and yet they claim that it was in harmony and bulk and scale with our community, which is, you know, a stretch.
But there's a lot more than just the visual impact, negative though that presumably would be. There is fears about the impacts on wildlife, for one thing, bighorn sheep, golden eagles, a lot of the major wildlife groups, Anzabrego Desert Park Foundation, the Nature Conservancy, Fish and Wildlife Service have all voiced serious concerns about the impacts on endangered species out there. And beyond that, water. I think the biggest issue out here that I've seen is the fact that we had the Eco Substation go in. They said it would use 30 million gallons of groundwater. It used 90 million gallons. And can you tell us how much groundwater the developer says these projects would use and some of the reasons that you believe it's going to use a lot more?
People don't realize that in the backcountry to build industrial-scale solar, you have to scrape all the chaparral, all the vegetation, and rearrange the soil. And when you do that, you release the carbon that's been sequestered there. It takes millions of gallons of water. And I believe they are up to almost 70 million gallons of water for these projects. And I said, we only have groundwater available. They're talking about taking water from the wells on site, but they're not sustainable enough, so they're going to have to import water from wells in Acumba and wells in Pine Valley.
So 70 million gallons that they admit to.
That they admit to. We caught them in a major omission. Howard Cook, the former chairman of the Acumba sponsor group, caught a major error where they had left out huge components of the project. And so they had to go back and revise their groundwater investigations and increase the water use by almost 40%.
Yeah, and there's some really big things that were left out of the environmental impact report during the time when the public had the right to give input and make comments. I'll give just one example here. They left out 160 battery modules, each one the size of a large metal ocean shipping container. And these are additions that you've said could exponentially increase the risk of fire. And, of course, there's a lot of groundwater that would be used for the concrete foundations for all these things. And yet they won't open up the AR. I mean, who would think
that was a late hit, and that was added to the final AR, 160 car containers worth of full of Lion batteries. And this is unprecedented in the world. We don't know of any place that is proposing such a huge amount of battery storage. So they're prone to fire, and they each have to have their own air conditioning and ventilation system, which uses a lot of energy. It just doesn't make sense to us to do all of this so far out away from the city where we use minimal, maybe 2 megawatts of energy for our entire community, when these projects should be built, distributed throughout the urban areas and suburban areas on existing structures and
right.
over
parking lots. And batteries, especially if there was a fire, as has occurred at some other battery storage facilities at big energy projects, there's also an issue with toxins being released in the smoke, dumped in the ground. It could become sort of a giant toxic waste dump, I would think.
Yes, that's a major issue for us. Our communities had to try and find the money to hire some experts to at least get this information into the administrative record. We are concerned that the Board of Supervisors will just go ahead and rubber stamp these projects, and then we're going to have to take them to court.
Yeah. We're going to get to the lawsuit in just a moment. I want to talk a little more about fire danger, though. These projects not only have the solar panels, but, of course, there's a lot of infrastructure, high-voltage power lines that they're going to be hooked up to. And yet your area is an area where there's been some big problems with a lack of fire safety. Closed fire stations during fire season. You've had multiple fires. The Harris Fire burned through this general area, fueled by 100-mile-an-hour winds.
So we had the 2,500-acre Shockey Fire, which burned 11 homes and killed one of my neighbors, which just missed the Tierra del Sol solar project. They proposed almost 10 miles of overhead high-voltage lines for these projects, and one of them goes right through the footprint of the Shockey Fire.
Yeah, and to be clear, we reported on the Shockey Fire. This was a fire that occurred when there were no other fires burning, and it was not a particularly high wind period. There were some winds, but nothing near what we saw during the Harris Fire, and yet even then, it rapidly spread out of control, burned houses, and as you've noted, killed an elderly gentleman. If they couldn't stop that when there was no other fire burning and not particularly severe weather conditions, how are they going to stop a fire that could start at this solar facility or even one that were to start off-site and then hit those batteries?
These are huge electrical generating facilities, and the Soitec CPV, their dual trackers, they have a lot of electrical components. They have inverters, they have transformers, they've got gears, and there's a lot of things that can go wrong electronically and can spark a fire. And those fires can get quickly out of hand. Even today, recently I learned that our Boulevard Fire Station was dark, meaning no firefighters there for 7 days in December and several days already in January. Now, the county is building a new fire station for us that will be managed by CAL FIRE. But there again, we are concerned, which has been consistently a problem, that there will not be the proper staff or the equipment on hand to handle these massive industrial fire potential.
Right. Last year we did a report and we found out that the Boulevard Fire Station was closed for 3 months during fire season. Our article kind of shamed some folks, I think, into coming up with emergency funding, but apparently the problem is still not completely solved. And also the foam truck that was part of the mitigation for some other energy projects out there and was supposed to be close by to make it easier to put fires out that would start at a big energy project, and we found out it was being stored at Lake Moreno, almost an hour away.
It was in another community because they weren't staffing Hucumba or Boulevard, and so you have to have staff to run equipment.
Yeah, it's just crazy. And then back to the water for a moment. Now, Victor Ponce, who is a hydrology expert at San Diego State University, studied this project, the Soitec solar proposals, and he concluded that if they were built at all, the water should be imported, because if they relied on groundwater, that it could forever change the ecosystem out there, devastate the ecosystem, because there simply would not be enough groundwater they would be using more than could be replaced by rainfall. So how can the planners down there just ignore that? I mean, what did they have to say about that?
They rely on consulting companies like DUDEC, and DUDEC is a consultant hired by the applicant to produce the environmental document and the groundwater investigations, and they are paid to say there's no problems. And so they put in a lot of empty information, and they hope that nobody reads these things and catches them.
Yeah, but DUDEC is the same company that has consistently underestimated water use at several other major projects recently. They don't seem to learn from their experience.
Dr. Ponce was hired by some homeowners around the Madeira Golf Course in Poway because they were concerned about the proposed pumping at groundwater wells that would dry up their wells. And DUDEC came in and said, oh, there's not a problem. So the city said, okay, go ahead and you can start pumping. And within 60 days, the neighbors' wells were drying up and there was problems at the golf course itself. So we've already got an evidence that DUDEC is not always right.
Right. Now, apart from all of the ecological problems, water use, fire danger, and certainly the inconvenience and potential loss of property values and rural character for the residents, there's another problem here. And that's that Soitec itself, which is a French company, they opened a factory in San Diego amid much hoopla, got a big federal grant. They were going to bring all kinds of jobs here to create these photovoltaic panels, concentrated photovoltaic panels. But Soitec is having serious financial problems. The issue is so bad. Their stock went down to just a quarter of what it was over the last year. And it's so bad that a Reuters analyst recommended that investors avoid Soitec stock. Like poison was the term they used. Many environmental publications have been coming out and energy industry publications predicting basically the failure of this facility here. And just within the last week or so, Soitec announced that they are laying off 100 people at the San Diego plant. So my question is, Donna, what are the ramifications if Soitec goes under or closes this facility? Who's going to maintain all these things and take care of them? I mean, are we concerned that a company with such big financial problems potentially could take some shortcuts that might come back to bite the community down the road?
That's a major concern, and one we've had all along. The Soitec concentrated photovoltaics, they're dual tracking, they're very expensive, much more expensive than the standard flat panel. They're not cost competitive at this point. In fact, independent analysts and Department of Energy peer review said they're basically out of the money and out of the market now. So, and even the board of directors for Soitec, the same day the planning commissioners were approving these projects, the board of directors for Soitec was saying, we're going to refocus our attention on areas other than solar. So the question is this facility even going to be here, the manufacturing facility? They've based a lot of the environmental document justifying it by the jobs that would be present at the manufacturing facility.
If, heaven forbid, the thing gets built, the supervisors approve it, and something bad happens. There's a fire, and it burns homes or spreads out of control and burns into San Diego. I guess it would be worst-case scenario that could occur, along with many other lesser-scale things that could go wrong. Do you think San Diego County taxpayers could be eventually on the hook for what might be construed as an irresponsible decision by the supervisors?
I haven't really thought things out that far. Anything is possible. The problem with these projects is they have no power purchase contracts. They originally had power purchase agreements with San Diego Gas and Electric, but through Soitec's inability to get these projects done, and one in Imperial County, and able to meet timelines and benchmarks, they've now lost all of their contracts. So they have zero power purchase contracts, and therefore they don't have any money coming in. I saw this morning on the county website that Soitec owes them another $20,000. The county wants that before the February 4th Board of Supervisors meeting, because this is all, staff. There's a lot of staff time involved in these projects.
So your group, BAD, Backcountry Against Dumps, which is an organization that started years ago fighting a landfill that was proposed out there successfully, I might add, and has since been kind of the rallying ground for other projects that the community has opposed. Your group has already stated publicly that if the supervisors approve this, you are going to file a lawsuit. Can you tell us a little bit about the grounds of that and what you think the likelihood is of success?
Backcountry has hired a Volcker law firm out of Oakland. He's got 40 years' experience in public interest environmental law, and he provided probably 50 pages of comments to the San Diego County Planning Commission, mm-hmm. just listing the number of violations of the California Environmental Quality Act, the fact that this project, the EIR, is inadequate, it's flawed. They should have produced and recirculated an amended environmental document for public review. Instead, they changed the project by adding the battery storage, increasing the amount of water being used, and we really weren't allowed public comment. It was released mid-December. On January 8th, the planning staff came to our Boulevard Planning Group meeting, and they already had the recommendations for approval, and they hadn't even heard any public comments or input.
Yeah.
So it's all predetermined, and in the word of many, the fix is in.
Wow. Certainly the supervisors, they're not here right now, but certainly they do have a mandate from the state that they have to meet certain renewable energy goals by certain dates not too far in the future. So I'm sure that that's top of mind. And certainly there's the issue of jobs for Soytech, which, you know, is a San Diego-based company. But that said, if you were put in charge of the state today, if you were Governor Brown or you were head of the Public Utilities Commission, Donna, if you don't want these projects, which clearly have a lot of negative impacts, what would your solution be to meet renewable power goals and help do our part to reduce the greenhouse gas problem?
Well, there's been studies conducted in San Diego County, Los Angeles County, and I know that in San Diego County they've determined there's over 7,000 megawatts of capacity on existing rooftops and over parking lots. So for point-of-use generation where the energy is used, and they can even put in some battery storage, that, in our minds, is the better answer, because then you don't have to have $2 billion Sunrise PowerLink projects and $435 million Eco Substation projects and all of the water that's used for these remote projects.
And yet that's going to take some legislative change, because right now some of the incentives for rooftop solar are actually astoundingly going away, and the renewable energy mandates coming down from the state are almost forcing these industrial-scale projects and not allowing the consideration of things like rooftop solar or, you know, personal-scale wind turbines or, you know, incentives and investments for that. So the whole thing seems a little bit upside down and backwards.
Well, aside from filing lawsuits, we're also working towards research and outreach on the county and other
state legislation.
Well, the other areas of the state have done what they call community choice aggregation, which is an alternative to the monopoly utilities.
Right.
Where an entity, the San Diego County or the region, could form their own community choice aggregation, and they would be responsible for purchasing the energy, generating the energy, and they could sell it at a nonprofit rate.
Yeah, so if listeners had solar on their roofs, they would be able to sell it back to the community choice aggregate, which is like a publicly owned power company that would be an alternative to SDG&E, and they could actually make some money at it and
have reduced rates, which is ideally the way that it would be. But right now you've got SDG&E monopoly utility out there, and they get a guaranteed rate of return on big infrastructure like all these power lines, and they want to do anything they can to block rooftop solar, which is the opposite of what is, in my opinion, the best for the ratepayers and the taxpayers.
The problem we've seen over and over with these projects, and it is worth noting that it isn't just this one project, huge though it is. This is one of several very, very massive industrial-scale energy projects that have been plopped into this area or proposed for this same area that's really being disproportionately targeted for the energy development. Thule Wind, Hecumbe Solar, the Sunrise PowerLink, the Eco Substation. We could go on and on. I mean, I know there's many more of them. What's the answer here, Donna? It seems like what happens every time one of these projects comes up before the supervisors is that East County's supervisor, Diane Jacob, typically will speak out, voice concerns, often vote against these things, and the other four just sort of rubber stamp it, ignore every single concern and vote them through. What is the answer to getting people in the San Diego region to understand the consequences for San Diego and sort of the loss of the playground area out here for San Diego and our back country with these decisions?
Well, we need people to mobilize and throughout San Diego County to call their supervisors and other supervisors and tell them they do not want to see the backcountry industrialized, that they would prefer rooftop solar and energy generation where it's consumed on public buildings and over parking lots rather than destroying the backcountry to build much more expensive projects that the ratepayers and taxpayers have to support.
And listeners, if you've just tuned in, we are talking with Donna Tisdale, who is the chair of the Boulevard Planning Group and the founder of Backcountry Against Dumps, or BAD, a community-based organization that has announced it is going to sue the county if supervisors on February 4th approve the very controversial industrial-scale Soytec solar projects for the Boulevard area. Don, if people want more information about this, or they want to get in touch, they want to maybe support the nonprofit with contributions or something, how can they reach you?
My phone number is 619-766-4170, and my email is tisdale.donna@gmail.com.
Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ?
Yes, East County matters, and what happens in our neighborhoods could happen in your neighborhood, and we would like to see a better alternative supported by the majority of the community.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Unlike, say, wind energy that can only go in an area that has very strong winds, a solar farm or industrial-scale solar project could go anywhere. So, you know, when they run out of land out here in the rural East County, it could just as easily be proposed in North County, in South County, in Central
County.
They
are being proposed there. That's why we're promoting point-of-use generation. That is the better alternative.
Yeah, there you go. Don, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ.
Thank you.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians.
Crime Stoppers is offering a $1,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of vandals who used paint and epoxy glue to damage a mailbox and signs. The suspects, both white, were caught on video on January 16th between 1:25 and 2:45 a.m. in the 11,000 block of Valle Vista Road in Lakeside's Eucalyptus Hills neighborhood. A reliable source told East County Magazine that around the same time, two local schools also suffered major damage from vandals who put epoxy in door locks, among other damage. The victim, who owns the mailbox, also runs two community sites on Facebook, including a neighborhood watch page. He believes he was targeted due to his efforts to keep his community safe and has asked that his name be withheld. The suspects also left four metal neighborhood watch signs on the victim's driveway. The victim estimated the damage at about $650. Anyone with information on the identity or location of the suspects is asked to call the Crime Stoppers anonymous tip line at 888-580-8477. Crime Stoppers is offering up to a $1,000 reward to anyone with information that leads to an arrest in this case. Anonymous email and text messages can be sent via crimestoppers.org. This has been Leon Thompson with a Crime Beat Report on East County Magazine.
This is Miriam Raftery with this week's Local Government Report. Here are some of the most important items on agendas of local boards, commissions, and councils this week in San Diego's East County. El Cajon's City Council meets on Tuesday, January 27th at 3 p.m. The council will hear a report from the police chief on a study looking at the feasibility of body cameras for El Cajon Police. Council will also hold a hearing on placing a lien against the Valley Motel on Mollison for abatement costs of substandard conditions. In addition, the council will interview applicants for vacancies on its Planning Commission, Veterans Commission, and Public Safety Facilities Oversight Committee. The La Mesa City Council meets Tuesday, January 27th at 6 p.m. Council will hear a presentation by Stephen Cushman, owner of Grossmont Center, on future plans for the regional shopping mall, where the lease with the city is coming up for renewal. There will also be an update on status of the city's downtown streetscape project. And a hearing will be held to develop five-year goals for community development block grants as well as fiscal year 2015-2016 allocations. Council will also consider adopting an in-lieu parking fee for some required off-street parking in downtown. Santee's City Council will hold its meeting Thursday, January 28th at 7 p.m. A public hearing will be held on 50 townhomes proposed on Simeon Drive and Bushy Hill Drive. Council will also award a construction contract for a river trail extension and for sidewalk access improvements at Carlton Oaks School. And then on January 27th, the La Mesa Spring Valley School District Board will choose a replacement to fill a vacancy left by Bill Baber's election to the La Mesa City Council. If you know of a hot agenda item coming up on a board or commission in your community in East County, contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org.
More San Diegans are getting jobs as unemployment dropped to 5.2% last month. This is down from 5.8% in December. This data was gathered in a monthly survey by the California Employment Development Department, or the EDD. The EDD collects data from all across the state in these surveys. Statewide, unemployment has dropped as well, down from 7.2% to only 7%. The survey reported a net growth of 700 non-farm jobs statewide. Leisure and hospitality reporting the largest increase at 8,300 new jobs. The largest loss in jobs was reported by government, which is down to 3,500 jobs, a 0.1% decrease. San Diego has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the state at 5.2%, with the highest being 21% in Imperial County and the lowest being 3.5% in San Mateo. There has been a very large amount of growth in the past year, with statewide unemployment being 8.5% last January. Reporting for KNSJ, this is Hayden Parsley.
This is Miriam Raftery with the weather report. Light to moderate rain is forecast for Monday night, with showers dissipating by Tuesday afternoon. Up to 1.25 inches of rain is possible in mountain areas, with less than 0.5 inch in valleys and desert regions. Clear weather is expected Wednesday, but more showers are expected Thursday, bringing a chance of additional showers later in the week, the National Weather Service predicts.
The La Mesa Police Department has been conducting an undercover shoulder tap operation along with agents from the State Alcohol Beverage Control, or ABC, targeting underage drinking and people who supply alcohol to minors. Officers made 36 visits to local businesses and solicited 86 people to buy alcohol for a minor. More than 30% agreed to do so and were arrested. The effort is the result of a grant from the ABC awarded to 47 law enforcement agencies. La Mesa received over $21,000, and the La Mesa Police Department says these operations will continue through July. Police say this is important to increase protection for youth in La Mesa and keep the community safe. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with today's Green Scene Report. The U.S. Department of the Interior announced Sunday that President Barack Obama plans to ask Congress to designate 12 million acres of Alaska's 19 million acre Arctic National Wildlife Refuge as wilderness to protect it from oil and gas drilling. The land in question is a narrow coastal plain between the Arctic Ocean and the Brooks Mountain Range that is vital habitat for migrating caribou herds and polar bears. If approved, the president's action could be one of the largest conservation steps since passage of the Wilderness Act 50 years ago, according to the Interior Department. A video released on YouTube contains images of the spectacular scenery and wildlife, along with a statement by President Obama on why he believes this area should be preserved for the future. Let's listen to what he has to say.
Alaska's National Wildlife Refuge is an incredible place, pristine, undisturbed. It supports caribou and polar bears, all manner of marine life, countless species of birds and fish, and for centuries it supported many Alaska Native communities. But it's very fragile, and that's why I'm very proud that my Department of Interior has put forward a comprehensive plan to make sure that we're protecting the refuge and that we're designating new areas, including coastal plains, for preservation. And I'm going to be calling on Congress to make sure that they take it one step further, designating it as a wilderness so that we can make sure that this amazing wonder is preserved for future generations.
Now, the Interior Department will begin managing the land as wilderness immediately, pending congressional action to assure no damage from oil drilling could occur in the interim. However, it's likely to face tough sledding in Congress, which is controlled by the Republicans. Both of Alaska's two Republican senators have voiced opposition to the plan. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who chairs the Senate Energy and Natural Resource Committee, accused the administration of treating Alaska like a territory. She complained, "The promises made to us at statehood and since then mean absolutely nothing to them." Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan says Obama's plan puts energy security in serious jeopardy, and both senators have vowed to fight to defeat the proposal. However, environmental leaders are hailing the plan. Gene Karpinski, president of the League of Conservation Voters, issued a statement noting Big Oil has long wanted to get its hands on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, but the scientists at the Fish and Wildlife Service declared that this iconic American wilderness is just too special to drill in. He concludes, "We wholeheartedly agree and celebrate this announcement by the Obama administration." Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell supports the action as well. "Just like Yosemite or the Grand Canyon," she says, "the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is one of our nation's crown jewels, and we have an obligation to preserve this spectacular place for generations to come."
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Kirk Lee Ader, author and photographer of the nonfiction book Child of the Storm, which recounts the life and surfing career of San Diego surf star Chris O'Rourke. My guest's work has appeared in publications such as Sports Illustrated, Outside, Islands, and Surfer, along with many international magazines. Ader has also co-authored Big Island Days and the Great Hawaii Sports Journal. Child of the Storm is his third book. Welcome, Kirk. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back in San Diego here. I grew up here, and it's always great to come back.
Let's start with a little historical information about Chris O'Rourke. I know that he also grew up in San Diego County, and at age 16, he became the number one rated surfer from mainland United States. He had only one goal, as I understand it, to become a world champion. Without giving too much away about your book, what happened to Chris and his dream, and how did you become involved in it?
Chris's story is very dynamic yet complex at the same time. He's actually originally from the East Coast, where the O'Rourke family all grew up, but they came to San Diego in the mid to late 60s and for various reasons had to almost flee the East Coast. And Chris and his father had a bit of a rift going on. When they arrived in San Diego, Chris didn't really want anything to do with surfing. He didn't like it at all. But his older brother, Bart, started surfing, and eventually Chris became hooked by it, too. And it really, he accelerated in surfing very, very quickly, learned how to surf at La Jolla Shores. Eventually, the family moved up towards Windansea, which, of course, a lot of people know can be a very localized surfing spot. Mm-hmm. Chris, with O'Rourke's, is a Irish background there, and Chris mm-hmm. had a kind of a fiery temper, and once he got out into the Windansea lineup and learned how to surf even better and better, he really released a lot of anger, I think, that he felt towards his father through his surfing, and he just fit right into the scene at Windansea, and before he knew it, his surfing just accelerated, and he became a very dynamic force and became very, very good at what he did.
Now, how did you become involved with him? How did you meet him and witness his life?
Sure. I actually first met him briefly when I was going to Scripps Elementary in La Jolla Shores in the sixth grade. The family had actually moved back to New York temporarily for a few months, but returned to La Jolla, and he was in my school for a few months. Then they moved back uptown, La Jolla, and then from there, he was in my grade at Muirlands Junior High in La Jolla, and then also in La Jolla High. And I started shooting surfing photographs in about the 10th grade at La Jolla High School. Mm-hmm. And at that time, well, Chris was the number one rated surfer from the U.S. mainland. So if I was going to get anywhere in my photography, he was the guy that I was going to shoot. I had the best guy right there. And I made it a point to try to shoot photos of him whenever possible. And that really kicked the whole thing off.
And what was it like seeing him surf that close and photographing it?
It was incredible. At the time, you know, in the mid-70s, surfing was kind of a misunderstood sport. The professionalism part was just getting off the ground. And surfing was searching for an identity. Was it an art form? Was it a sport? But there were a lot of people that were trying to elevate it to a higher level, and even Chris at a young age was one of those. He was a prodigy surfer in so many ways, just like 11-time world champion Kelly Slater is today. Mm-hmm. He was winning all the contests. He was beating the guys 10 years older than him. He elevated through the ranks of what was called the WSA, Western Surfing Association. And he got put in the 4A category when he was 14 years old. That's how good he was, because normally that division is reserved for surfers 18 years old or older. Mm-hmm. He just really elevated through the ranks very fast. And before you know it, he was right there at the top. When the WSA folded in 1976, Chris was the number one rated surfer in the 4A division. And then when the Pro Tour started that same year, he was all set to go on the Pro Tour, but unfortunately he was still in high school. So he kind of had to wait till the following year in 1977, which he did. But he was the first guy from California to really lead the charge and take it to the rest of the world. At that time, surfing was dominated by South Africans, Hawaiians, and Australians.
So, Do you remember what you thought when you first saw him surf?
I thought he was a dominant force, and he definitely stood out far above the rest of the surfers that I saw in the water through his maneuvers and everything. He was clearly the best guy out there.
And what a challenge to capture it on film.
And on film, it was great. Of course, back then, it was manual focus cameras,
right,
and shooting slide film, and not like the technology we have today, which is, of course, great. So you kind of had to be conservative also, too, in how you shot your film, because every press of the button of the shutter cost you money. So, but with Chris, it was good because all the maneuvers he did were very, very strong.
Now, I know that Chris died before his time of cancer in 1981, and you're quoted as saying that his story is not about duration, but about brilliance.
That's correct.
What lessons do you believe are highlighted by Chris for anyone who reads about them?
I think the first really key lesson is that, and I'm a firm believer in this, if you have your health, you have everything. And anybody who's healthy, if you know, there's always going to be other troubles and good things and bad things in your life. But obviously cancer is a big factor for a lot of people today. Both my parents have had cancer. They're still alive today. They've been able to battle it. But what I learned from Chris is if you're healthy, you have a lot. And I'm reminded of that all the time in my own life. If I ever have a bad day, all I have to do is think about Chris, and it really kind of kicks me back into place. And realize, well, again, I'm healthy, I have good things going on, and I try to look at it that way. He had some family issues, too, and I think if you have a strong family, that's good. There's so many variables in this book to talk about and to go through. It really touches on a lot of different aspects of life, tragedy, turmoil, greatness, friendships, and ultimately inspiration, which he did. He inspired so many people by his fight for survival and to go through life, and he fought right up until the very end.
Now, do you see his surfing as a metaphor of that kind of, I don't know, strength and endurance, or do you see it as the beauty of the sport?
Most definitely, surfing kept him alive, in my opinion, longer than he should have survived. He got such a strength from going out in the ocean and surfing, and he also got really a lot of strength because he had a wife and a son. And those three factors right there really played a big role, I think, in extending his life. Surfing, though, he was drawn to the ocean like a magnet. Mm-hmm. And the ocean, of course, when you're surfing, there's so many variables and factors out there. It's not just the surfing on the wave itself, but the environment of being in the ocean And that really played a large part in his life. And
passion.
Passion, exactly.
Well, speaking of passion, you've had a long career as a photojournalist. Give us an inside look what it's like to photograph surfers and other amazing things to see and photograph. How do you get the right shot? And what's the process of capturing an exciting sport like that?
Well, I'm going to back up again here. Surfing in the mid-70s was kind of just searching for an identity. Now, today, there's a billion-dollar industry behind it, and it's really come a long way. For me to shoot surfing from the mid-70s up until today, I've seen a lot of that progress, and I've been able to go out and shoot events on the Pro Tour at different countries around the world and see guys come and go from different countries. And it's really been great to see how surfing has progressed as a sport, the maneuvers, the art form itself, and all the different identities that have evolved, and that's been the greatest thing. In the mid-70s, you had just surfing. Surfing spread then and created other sports like windsurfing, kite surfing, even other sports like land sports like snowboarding. So it's the evolution of the whole thing is what's been great to witness, and there's been certainly a lot of that. And surfing has gone from just being, you know, thought of in the old Gidget movies and the Beach Boy music and all that today, like I said, to this billion-dollar industry with huge companies like Quiksilver and Billabong, and it's really been a great thing.
But how do you get close enough to photograph the exciting moments?
Well, of course, you have your water cameras. You're swimming out there in the water, which is takes a lot of skill and expertise to get in, you know, on the wave and be on the wave, and you can shoot. Mostly you're swimming and trying to get in the right position, and that can be a difficult task depending on what surf spot you're shooting. But when you're not using the water camera, you use large telephoto lenses, just like when you're shooting football or something like that, and being on the beach and being able to capture the entire wave. And so it's either shooting with telephoto lenses or water cameras, but either way, it's a really neat and fun thing to do.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it is. Yeah. I have one more question for you, Kirk. Okay. What's next? What are you working on now?
Well, it's an extension of the Child of the Storm book. We're actually trying to get and very close to having the Child of the Storm book be picked up by a movie producer. And we're trying to get that done, and we're very close. But as everyone knows, I'm working with Hollywood and everything. It takes a while for these things to happen. But I'm hoping that in the next year that'll happen. I'm taking a little break from the writing part because The Child of the Storm took me 9 years to do. So it was pretty much a very extensive project, being that you're dealing with real people, real lives.
Sure.
So I decided to kind of take a break from that. And living in Hawaii, I just continue my photography over there.
Okay. Well, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me today again. It's been great.
For more information on Kirk Ader and his work, please visit his website at www.kirkaderphoto.com. And Ader is spelled A-E-D-E-R, kirkaderphoto.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
A little more than half the economy of Southern California is dependent in some way on the health of the Colorado River system. That's the finding of a new report that quantifies the value of the river to the 7 western states that use it. Researchers at Arizona State University say about 7 million jobs are affected by industries that use Colorado River water in 7 California counties. Kevin Tilden with American Water, a company that manages investor-owned water utilities around the state, says these findings broaden the outlook beyond recreation and farming.
Well, I think when they see the images of the reservoirs at low levels, they think of this boating season or, you know, this growing season if they're in agriculture. And I think the study says really the economic impact and the trillions of dollars is such that we need to be thinking about the much longer term.
Tilden says in California, the report underscores the importance of the massive water bond passed by voters in November. The research indicates Colorado River water is the lifeblood of many communities, with an overall economic effect of $1.4 trillion across the 7 states. It also says federal agencies should do a better job of collecting and reporting water usage data. The report authors say their research is the first of its its kind to quantify economic impact to a wide variety of industries, from real estate to healthcare, finance, manufacturing, and more. Economist Tim James at Arizona State says his team created an economic model for each of the seven states in the Colorado Basin and combined them.
And then we work out how much water is entailed in all the different production processes. So it then tells us how much each sector is reliant on water, and then what would happen if that water was no longer available? How much would you be able to produce?
James notes that it's unlikely every drop of Colorado River water would go away, so the study results can be adjusted by percentage of water loss. But demand already exceeds the supply, and the report says even a 10% decrease in available water could mean a hit of more than $143 billion to the basin states. For Public News Service, I'm Chris Thomas.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show.
We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space,
to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso.
We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery.
We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road,
A.K. Jules,
Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road.
We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment.
If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.